At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating U.S. Wendy's during breakfast hours.
Ready? Andy Malt.
Yeah.
The CMU Podcast, in association with 7Digital.
This week, Victory Records, Apple Music, Sony ATV, and Busted. I'm Andy Malt, editor of CMU. Over there, you can't see where over there is, but anyway, over there is Chris Cook, business editor of CMU. And Chris, you've been to a lot of events again this week, but I'm frankly bored of talking about you going to events. So I think we should start this week's podcast by talking about my garden.
Your garden?
I've had some work done in my garden.
Has there been a music business related event in your garden?
There were some fireworks in it.
That's not music business related.
Then no.
Are you planning a festival in your garden?
Well, once my garden has been cleared up, because it's in quite a state at the moment, there might be room for a very small festival.
Malt Fest.
Slash party. Well, it could be like Leaf Fest.
Leaf Fest is coming back. It took a year off. It's coming back.
Well, celebrate its 10th anniversary,
I've just reminded myself that I meant to include that in today's CMU Daily, and I forgot. So apologies to Leaf Fest that we didn't cover the fact that you've confirmed that you're coming back next year. But yes, inspired by Leaf Fest, which began in Lee's back garden, Malt Fest. I'm looking forward to it. So it's providing you stage Malt Fest at some point in 2016, then you're allowed to talk about your garden on the CMU podcast.
Back when I was trying to think of names for the label I used to run, which I think we've discussed on the podcast before, someone suggested that I call it Malt and Rock, like Malt and Rock, but Malt and Rock.
Yeah.
So that could be the name of the festival.
I think you were wise not to name your label that, and I think we'll leave it.
Probably wise not to name a festival that. But Lee Fest, I mean, who would have thought that would become a proper festival?
Lee, perhaps. Although he claims not, doesn't he?
I don't think he did, because I don't think he would have called it Lee Fest if he had.
If I'm not allowed to talk about the events I've been to, can I talk about the events I'm going to? As in future tense.
Yes.
Because this podcast is all about looking forward.
Yeah, all right, go on.
I say going to, I really mean
running. Selling tickets for.
So the CMU Insights Masterclasses, that's new. It's me. I'm the master at the masterclasses. It's a bit arrogant, that, really, isn't it?
It's quite arrogant.
Now I come to think of
it. But that's you all over.
So, the first of our CMU Insights masterclasses, of which I will be the master, is navigating the digital market, which is taking place on the 7th of December. Tickets are selling. Buy your ticket at CMU Insights.
They're selling fast.
Come.
Oh, they're almost sold out.
I'm going to tell you how the digital market is looking as we head into 2016, which services are people using? Which services are paying money into the industry? Where are we heading? I have five challenges that the music industry faces in the digital domain in the next 12 months.
Just five.
Be able to come along and count all five of the challenges. And then, not only that, I'm going to explain how digital services are licensed. So in the book, what's the book called? It's not called Navigating, is it? Dissecting the Digital Dollar. That's what the book's called.
You're calling it a book now?
Yeah, well, it is.
It was a report last week.
Well,
now it's a book.
Well, it's a report in a book. The book is quite long. So if you've not had time.
It's not as long as a book.
If you've not had time. Well, how long is it? It's about 70 pages.
Yeah.
How many pages do it need to be before it's
a book?
How many
books have you read that were 70 pages?
Well, as you know,
since you passed childhood.
As you know, I don't really read books. So I don't really know how long the average book is.
That's another thing I did. I bought some comics this week.
I would be.
They were quite short.
I would be put off any book that's more than 70 pages. So if you've not had time to read the book, then come to Navigating the Digital Market. That's what we're calling it, isn't it? Dissecting Digital Dollar.
Navigating the Digital Market Masterclass, as it says here.
Come to the masterclass. Come to the class and be mastered in all things digital. CMUinsights.com.
Once again, you've made the podcast sound creepy. And this event. This entire event now sounds creepy and no one is going to come.
Do come. It's great. It'll be good. I'll bring mince pies.
Will
it's
you?
Nearly Christmas.
Will you, though?
Nearly Christmas.
You have brought matchmakers to this momentous recording of the podcast.
I may only bring 6 mince pies, so get there early. But there will be at least 1 box of mince pies, which I will probably purchase from my local pan shop, which is where I bought the matchmakers from. Because I realised, coming in today, that this is the 23rd edition of the CME podcast since we came back.
Yeah, so it's a milestone, as I said.
So, is that what you said?
Well, I might have said.
You fought it, even if you didn't say it.
I said it definitely before we started.
So
before you spontaneously made that comment after I looked up how many podcasts we recorded.
Counted in the content
and realised earlier today.
How many?
Don't lie to the listeners.
When
you realised nothing.
Actually, I didn't realise it was anywhere near 23. I can't quite believe you've been doing this. Actually, if you think about it, I'd rather forget the one where I phoned in from Edinburgh, because that wasn't very pleasant for either me or the listener. So that makes it 22, and that's a more round number. So 22 is definitely
something. I mean, you could cut out
all the Edinburgh.
All of the Edinburgh.
Well, that then takes us, what, to 17 or something, and that's no good. So, anyway, I bought chocolates for this
Yeah,
edition.
Which I can't reach.
Well, there you go.
But anyway, chocolates. You're not supposed to eat on the podcast. That's a rule.
Do you able to hear me crunching the matchmakers?
Oh, I can hear you got your mouth full.
That's not very nice, is it?
It's not.
But now I've started one, I need to finish it.
Well, shall I tell you something about the digital market? You mentioned where the digital market's at. I can tell you where it is at as of right now. Right now, Victory Records catalogue in the US is available on Spotify. And that is a thing to note, because I think we discussed on the podcast recently, not last week, but possibly the week before, that the Victory Records catalogue had been taken down by Spotify. And the reason for that was because Victory Records' sister company, publishing company Another Victory, which we went over how stupid and confusing that is, was in a dispute with Spotify over, it claims, it had not been paid mechanical royalties on 53 million streams.
So Victory Records is a rock label based in the US. They have a few sizable acts on there. They're quite a serious concern in the US market. And as you say, actually, the dispute was about their publishing catalogue, but for complicated reasons, which are partly what the entire dispute was about, it was really hard for them to just pull the Victory publishing catalogue from Spotify. So instead, they pulled the recordings catalogue, even though that meant pulling a load of recordings which were not actually part of the dispute.
Yes, but as you say, I think we discussed before how complicated it is, and we've certainly discussed it in the CMU Daily. So you can go to completemusicupdate.com, put Victory Records into the search box, hit search, and it may or may not bring up the story you want, which explains how bloody complicated the mechanical royalties are in the US.
You might end up, because the search on our website is not brilliant, you might end up with a story about Victory Records from 8 years ago. But what you'll probably find is the only time we ever cover Victory Records is when they're having a squabble with somebody.
Yes.
They are a label that has had a number of squabbles over the years.
No
but
squabble
this one,
here.
This one's settled.
Yeah. I think we talked up both here and on the website about how
this was going to be a
this
big,
would be a big
battle.
Thing because Victory is always up for a fight. And then, in fact, you know, 3 weeks later, Victory's gone, yeah, we're all friends again now. Catalogue's back on Spotify. They've reached a resolution that everyone's happy with. Time to move on.
Now, someone in the last week, one of the events that I went to, which I'm not talking about, but someone said, oh, what is it about Victory Records suing Spotify about mechanicals? And actually, it never got that far.
There was no suing.
The dispute had been running for a number of weeks, possibly months, because Victory had hired this company, Audiam, who are specialists in mechanical royalties on streaming services in the US. It was them that had worked out the 53 million figure or whatever it was.
Yes.
And so another Victory had gone to Spotify and said, we're owed royalties for these songs that you have streamed. Spotify at no point said, we're not giving you the money. Spotify said, oh, we need to do a deal. And then it all seemed to come to a head because Spotify said, well, let's do a deal. Here's a contract. Sign the contract. And then Victory said, oh, we can't do that because we've hired this company, Audiam. It's because of them that we even know there's a problem here. And if we were to do a direct deal with you now, that would be breach of contract. And therefore, we can't do that deal. And then seemingly, that was the point at which Spotify pulled the content. Although, I think it was Tony Brummel. That's the name, isn't it? The guy who runs Victory Records.
It is. Well done.
He gave an interview. I can't remember who this was with. It was possibly Billboard or it was another of the American music, digital music sites. And he was basically saying that they'd been having this debate for a number of weeks, a number of months. It hadn't been a particularly confrontational conversation. And then at one point, I think perhaps when this contract was starting to be mentioned, Tony Brummel CC'd in on the email exchange his lawyer, simply so his lawyer knew that a contract had been mentioned. And then I think Spotify interpreted that as, oh my God, this is going legal. So they CC'd in their lawyer. And then just by CCing some lawyers into the conversation, suddenly what had been conversation, it was just going backwards and forwards, it wasn't any conversational, suddenly the music's off Spotify. So I think there's a moral to this story. It's never CC a lawyer on any emails.
That, ladies and gentlemen, is why lawyers are so wealthy. It's really all it takes.
Yeah, the minute they get added to a conversation, suddenly things go legal. Hurrah, the lawyers get some money. So, although this dispute has been resolved quite quickly and A, the music is back. Obviously, it's only ever affected the US version of Spotify, so we were not able to experience the lack of Victory Records music on Spotify. We were deprived that experience here in the UK. But the music is back, and also Victory Records put out a nice little statement saying it was all fine, we're all happy.
Yeah. Well, they tweeted, "We're back," all caps, and then they and a link to a playlist on Spotify that contains lots of their music, just to prove that it definitely was there. It was a playlist that was there before this all happened anyway, so obviously they were a label active on Spotify. They're not an anti-Spotify label. Tony Brummel spoke to Digital Music News and just said, yeah, we're really happy to be back on Spotify. Everything's fine. We came to a good resolution that works for everybody. No problems here.
But although this story has resolved itself very fast, the issue around the way mechanical royalties are paid by streaming services in America, so that is the mechanical portion of the song copyright, we've talked about it before on the podcast, won't go into any detail, but that issue remains. And actually, Jeff Price, who set up and continues to run Audiam, has been very vocal about this for a couple of years. Yeah. And I think, you know, lots of particularly independent publishers are slowly starting to catch up that for various reasons, partly because of the insane way song licensing is done with digital in the US. Lots of independent publishers are not getting paid by Spotify, but all the other streaming services too. And those services are probably sitting on the money. It's not that the money is being deviously spent by somebody.
They are saving it up.
It's just sitting in a bank account and it is not getting through to the people. So it's not getting to the publishers. And if it's not getting to the publishers, it means it's not getting to the songwriters. And capitalising on this dispute between Victory and Spotify, David Lowry, who is a singer-songwriter himself, he's a musician, remind me the bands he was in.
Cracker and Camper Van Beethoven.
And as well as being a musician and a jobbing singer-songwriter, he has become almost a spokesman for angry songwriters in the US in recent years. He talks a lot and writes a lot about digital and digital royalties and has become quite confrontational, initially with services like Pandora, which obviously use the compulsory licenses in the US and are seen to often play the system to bring their royalty commitments down. But subsequently, that anger has spread onto other services like Spotify. So he often speaks against Spotify. And he wants this issue to be addressed now about the mechanical royalties. And he very much takes the position that some songwriters and certainly some publishers are sort of forgiving of the Spotify's when these mechanicals don't get paid, because one of the reasons they don't get paid is because there's no central database of song ownership. So Spotify knows what songs have been performed, but it doesn't know who controls the publishing. And so it's really hard for Spotify to just go and write the check. So they need to hire people to go and work it all out for them. And so some publishers are like, yeah, that's sort of our fault for not having a nice, easy to use global repertoire database, as it was going to be called when they were talking about doing this. It's sort of our fault, so we don't get angry with Spotify when they don't pay us the mechanicals. Whereas what David Lowry is saying is, and indeed I know Jeff Price from Audium has said this as well, okay, perhaps some of this is the fault of the publishers, but nevertheless, the compulsory license under which services like Spotify get the rights to the mechanical element of the song copyrights, the compulsory license says it is your obligation to go and find the copyright owner and alert them to the fact that you're using their content.
Send them a letter of intent.
Yes, so that the system is in place for the royalties to be paid. And just because the system's a bit nuts, that's not an excuse to not do the work. And anyway, you're all incredibly well-funded tech companies. You can afford to have a department doing this. And actually, I thought the one practical thing that he said when he was writing about this earlier this week is, at the very least, why doesn't Spotify just publish a list of all of the songs where they don't know where to pay the mechanical royalties? So then as a songwriter or a publisher, you could go on and look at that list and say, oh, look, that's one of my songs. Right, I need to get in touch with Spotify to let them know. So that was one of the suggestions that he wrote. And this wasn't just writing a blog post. He does blog a lot on these issues. But this wasn't just a blog post. This was a letter he was sending to somebody important.
Yes, the New York Attorney General. who he wrote to and said, you should do an investigation into this and how this is happening and what should be done about it. Because he said, this is very similar to something that was happening with the labels, whenever that was.
About
11 years ago. And then the then New York Attorney General did run an investigation into this and there was a resolution to it. And he's saying, these two cases are very similar. You should sort this out.
So Eliot Spitzer was the New York Attorney General back in 2003, 2004. And the investigation then was that record companies were doing a really bad job about paying royalties, the recording royalties this time, rather than song royalties. And in some ways, there was a similar allegation, which was saying when labels lose touch or lose the contact information, you know, when the people that they're meant to be paying move and they no longer have a way of getting in touch, rather than the labels proactively going out and finding those people and making sure they get their money, they just sort of sat back and said, oh well, we'll just leave the money sitting in our bank account accruing interest. And a big investigation took place, and the record companies, I imagine it would be predominantly the majors, said, all right then, we'll up our game, we'll make sure that we do everything we can to pay people the royalties that they are due. Spitzer, he also led on the payola stuff. He was the guy that did the most recent of the payola campaigns, looking at record companies paying or bribing in kind radio stations to get their music played. So for Eliot Spitzer, dodginess in the music industry was something that interested him. And I'm not sure the current Attorney General will be so interested in getting involved and intervening in this issue. But nevertheless, it is an attempt to put an issue which has been talked about at music conferences and which we had, you know, an actual proper spat in public on this issue, trying to put it onto the political agenda. It remains to be seen how Mr. Attorney General responds.
Apple Music is now available on Android phones, which is quite a milestone because it's the... Well, actually, we discovered it's not the first app. As much as people have talked about it being the first Apple app on Android phones, there is another app that lets you transfer all your stuff on your Android phone to your new iPhone. So that's there. But this is the first kind of app that stays on your Android phone.
And provides services to your Android phone.
It arrived 4 months after it launched on iOS and well, Apple platforms generally, your laptops as well, and computers, all of that. Apple's had Apple Music for 4 whole months. Android left out in the cold. But not anymore. Originally, we thought that might be because basically Apple just wanted to lock Android users out of the 3-month free trial that it was offering. But no, Android users get a 3-month free trial. They get full access to Apple Music. They can access their iTunes purchases. The only thing they don't get is access to the iTunes store.
Which is interesting, yeah. So I think beyond were they going to give Android users the 3-month free trial, there was an expectation, because they said from the start, didn't they, that there was going to be an Android version of the app. So we knew it was coming, but how much of the Apple experience would you get on Android? And would they strip it back and would you lose some of the things? But as you say, pretty much everything you get on an Apple device is there on the Android device. And actually, for the first time, it allows you to access in a really easy way your iTunes catalogue.
Yeah.
You can't buy new tracks from iTunes, so the iTunes store isn't there, but your catalogue is there. Because I think for Android users who are otherwise iTunes users, that has always been one of the frustrations with an Android phone, that it's not very easy to get your MP3s or technically AACs onto your phone. And lots of the other download services that you can access on Android, so like Google Play or the Amazon store, the user experience is nowhere near as good as the iTunes user experience. So it is interesting that Apple Music on Android does seem to do pretty much everything that it does on an Apple device.
Yeah, and then Eddie Q of Apple gave an interview to TechCrunch where he really talked up whether this is the case or not. He was spinning it as it had taken a bit longer to get it onto Android because they really wanted to make this feel like an Android app. They didn't want it to just be an iOS app that had been ported across and didn't quite work properly and looked like an iOS app when in fact it was running on an Android phone. He was like, we want to get everything down to like the share button. We want it to look like an Android share button, not an iOS share button. Everything should be nice and familiar to the Android user. And it's just taken a little while to get it just right. I mean, it's still in beta. I think things aren't quite right, but they're having a good go.
They're having a good go. Now, unfortunately, both myself and Andy Malt have exclusively Apple devices. And we are based in a building full of little music companies and predominantly digital and other startup companies. So therefore, we are in a building where every single device, whether it is a computer or a laptop or a tablet or a phone, is Apple.
People who turn up with Android devices are turned away at the door.
So we have no way of testing this and, you know, testing whether Eddie is right, that this does feel like an Android app and it sort of has the Android
logo. I don't know
what
an Android app feels like.
I didn't know they were different until Eddie said so.
I did know they're different because they look quite clunky.
But so that's what they did. They had to take their really smooth, super-duper app and make it all clunky and horrible. Having said that, the Apple Music iOS app has had mixed reviews ever since it went live earlier this summer. So it's not like it has been hugely acclaimed, oh, this is the best music experience ever, and now it's available on Android.
No, so part of the mixed reviews of the Android app could certainly be down to that. But as much as this is being spun by Apple as being, we just want to be nice to Android people, there's no, you know, which is quite a shift for Apple. Apple is not known for kind of, although they did eventually put iTunes on Windows computers, they're not really known for going, oh yeah, well, we should just let everyone use our stuff. We should, and that would be nice for everyone. We'll make it look nice for everyone, whatever platform they're using. Apple's very much a, no, this is my stuff and you can't have it sort of company. So why are they now appearing to be all fluffy? Is this the shift from the Steve Jobs era to the Tim Cook era, where just Apple's a nice, fluffy company now? It's not like that kind of grab it all, keep it within the walled garden thing. Or is it related to something Tim Cook said in an earnings call recently, which is that 30% of new iPhone customers are transferring from Android? So in fact, if you make something look good on Android, is it really a way to draw more than 30% over?
So basically, it's a massive marketing campaign to sell more iOS devices. And it's interesting, is it that Apple Music, because I suppose back in the day when the iTunes Store first launched, it was no secret that for Apple, the iTunes Store was not a business in itself. It was just a way of selling devices, because Apple launched the iPod. It was a cool MP3 player. It wasn't an MP3 player, was it? An AAC player. Played MP3s. People liked it, but no one could get any legal music to play on it. So then Apple launched the iTunes Store to sell content to go on the iPods, and then they sold a lot of devices, and then the iPhone. And so ultimately, the aim of the iTunes Store was to sell devices, not music, not content. But in doing so, Apple ended up being a really major retailer and selling all this digital content and making a lot of money from it. So the iTunes Store was not originally intended as a business in itself, but it became a business in itself. Now we have the shift from downloads to streaming and Apple Music. And there's an element of, well, is Apple Music, like iTunes originally, really just about selling devices? It's just about selling Apple devices, and that's what it's there for. Or do they have aspirations for it to become a profitable business like the iTunes Store did? I mean, it's harder to make a streaming service a profitable business than it is to make an iTunes download store a profitable business. So what is their motivation with Apple Music? And therefore, is it that they really want to take on a Spotify? And if they really seriously want to take on Spotify worldwide, they have to be on Android, really, because otherwise you're at a massive disadvantage to one of your competitors, because Spotify can be proudly agnostic in terms of what devices it works on, both in terms of portable devices, but also things like, you know, TV devices, in-car devices, and so on and so forth. So is it that Apple are clever enough to say, we basically want to compete with and ultimately beat Spotify at the streaming music game, and we simply can't do that by locking it to our own devices? Or is it, as you said, really, actually, it's just a marketing platform to try and get people? And I suppose this assumes that Apple are arrogant enough to think, although Apple probably are arrogant enough to think, that people are going to open up Apple Music on their Android phone and say, wow, this is the best experience I've ever had on a mobile device. Oh, imagine all the other things I could be getting if I had all the Apple experiences. Oh, I'm going to go and buy an iPhone.
Yeah, and I mean, I think Apple probably is that arrogant. I mean, the announcement of Apple Music sort of showed that
They really thought it was the best thing ever.
I mean, you know, when they're doing a demonstration, they're going like, look at this. You can pull up a playlist, right, and check this out. You can move the order of your tracks around. I'd never seen that before, have you? They clearly thought it was the bee's knees.
I mean, the interesting...
But subsequently, more than one person from Apple has said, yeah, we need to do some work on this.
Yeah, learning curve. We're, yes, we are certainly developing this platform.
And it's interesting,
obviously,
quite un-Apple.
Google through Google Play have their own download store and streaming music service.
Yeah.
And that is fully available there. Although it still strikes me that most Android phone owners think of Google Play as an app store and don't actually realise that it has all of this music stuff going on in the background. But beyond Google Play, obviously, YouTube Red is rolling out, and there is the standalone YouTube Music app, which I believe, as we speak, is finally going online, having been announced a few weeks ago. So Google and via YouTube is also in the streaming music game. But nevertheless, I sense that most Android users don't tend to use Google-owned music services. They are using a Spotify or a Deezer or an Audio or whatever, and now Apple Music can compete head-on with those. There is one other thing that we are actually still trying to get to the bottom of, but if what we are thinking is happening is true, would suggest that actually ultimately this is a marketing thing. It is about trying to convince people that the Apple experience is super duper, get rid of your Android phone and upgrade. And that's the fact that as far as we can see, as you said, the 3-month free trial is available to people signing up on an Android device. But the information suggests that at the end of the 3 months, when they start having to pay, it will be £9.99 a month, pounds, euros, dollars, whatever.
Not controversial. However, I think we've talked about the Apple tax here on the podcast before. And the Apple tax is basically, Apple takes a 30% cut of in-app purchases. So if you subscribe to Spotify through Spotify's iOS app, then Apple takes 30% of that, which is Spotify's profit margin. So Spotify charges more if you subscribe that way than if you subscribe through its own software or website.
And I think the reason we talked about that on the podcast recently was, I mean, that has always been the case. So Spotify has to pass the 30% charge
on the customer. So it's $12.99 a month rather than $9.99 a month.
And that became an issue once Apple Music started rolling out, because it meant that Apple Music had an unfair advantage on iOS devices, because they could be $9.99. They didn't have to, you know, they didn't have to pay themselves 30% twice. So it meant now that if you purchase in-app on an Apple device, Apple has an unfair advantage over Spotify and all the others because they don't have to do the markup. And so, first of all, Spotify emailed all of their users who were paying the premium saying, do you know that if you cancel your account on in-app payments and you were to sign up on Spotify.com and then just log in on your iOS device, you could save £3 a month? And then there was talk of asking, I can't remember who it was it Department of Justice or somebody, Securities Exchange Commission, somebody in America, to investigate whether or not that is Apple sort of exploiting its dominance and its controlling of the Apple App Store. I don't think that ever really came to anything, but it was definitely a debate that was had around the launch of Apple Music. But Google does the same thing with its App Store. If you do in-app purchases on an app on the Android system, Google likewise takes 30%. So the extra £3 are charged on those other services if you pay in-app through Google as well. So that means that anybody who subscribes to Apple Music once the 3-month trial is up, with in-app purchasing on an Android phone through the Google Play ecosystem, well, Google is taking 30% of the money. And as we know with streaming services, that is your profit margin. At best, you're seeing 30% of the post-tax revenue, because the record companies and the publishers between them will want at least 70% of the revenue.
And in fact, in Apple Music's case, they made a big deal of how they were going to pay a little bit more than 70%. So actually, potentially, it's running at a loss.
So therefore, if this is true, now we're still trying to get to the bottom of this. We're talking to Apple. We're talking to some of the people who have relationships on the label side. But if that is true, and therefore, basically, Apple Music on Android devices will be operating at best at break even for Apple, well, then that means that it isn't that they have aspirations for Apple Music to be a standalone business that generates revenue. It is a loss leader marketing platform. And it's all about them hoping that the Apple Music experience will be wow people so much that they'll think, oh, I want the full Apple experience. I have to say, there's lots about Apple. I mean, yes, we've already admitted we are completely Apple users and we're surrounded by Apple users. I think there's an awful lot about Apple devices, which is why I like them. Apple Music is not one of them.
No, it wouldn't be the thing that drew me in.
Yeah, so I don't know whether that will actually work. But still, we're still trying to dig on that. So we will. Who knows, by next time on the podcast, we might know more about that. If it is a big marketing platform, well, I guess they're, I mean, I don't even know how they know the 30% switch from Android to iPhone. Presumably they ask people when they buy and they tick a box or something. Or but they might know if files are being transferred. Anyway, if that is what they're trying to do here, then I guess the success of Apple Music on Android, as far as Apple are concerned, will be whether or not they can get that 30% rate conversion from Android devices to iOS devices up. So time now to recap what has been approved in the CMU Daily this week. And Andy Malt is going to tell us.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
Mm.
Halik Moore.
Yes, Halik Moore. He is a Brooklyn-born, Barbados-raised rapper.
And Big Z would be proud of that description. Big Z, he of the Club Tip, is a big fan of telling you where everybody he tips comes from. So thanks for the background information there.
Well, possibly more interesting about him then, if you didn't like that. He released an EP and a mixtape back in 2012 when he was 16 years old and got quite a lot of attention. And rather than capitalising on that attention and riding the wave of fame and money, he decided to finish school.
In Barbados, presumably.
Yeah. And now 3 years later, he's done that. And he's back. Potentially a risk, because 3 years is a long time in music.
It is.
But he's back. He's worked with some good producers on this new mixtape he's just put out called Prince Midas, out now. You can get it, listen to it on Spotify. And the track I put in CMU Daily is called Money God. It features Saul Williams. See, none of your rubbish guests. Saul Bloody Williams.
Yeah.
It's got Kill J, who are a Danish electro-pop duo, are on the mixtape as well. It's very good.
Of course, if he now goes to university, that'll be another 3 or 4 years
yeah.
until we get a follow-up. So make the most of it while you can. Anna von Hauswolf.
Anna von Hauswolf is back this month with her third album. If you don't know Anna von Hauswolf...
I do.
Which, no, you don't.
I do.
She does play the organ, yes.
With lots of pipes.
Yes. Stop reading my notes.
I remembered the pipes. I didn't have to read it.
All right.
Because it's a lot of pipes.
9,000.
Yeah. See, that's the sort of thing you remember.
Not always. Just this album. She went somewhere in the north of Sweden. There's an organ that has 9,000 pipes, and she used that for recording her new album. I guess it's rock music. There's guitars, drums on there, and it's very dramatic music, as you might expect from an album with 9,000 pipes playing on it. I don't know what she does when she performs live. I presume she has a few fewer pipes, possibly just an electric organ. But you can see when she plays Oslo in London on the 8th of December. And if you go to the CMU-approved section of the website... Which you would. You can go to her approved. You can listen to An Oath on that page. And there are two other tracks you can link off to. Or, in fact... as this podcast goes out, the album is being released, so you can just listen to the whole thing on Spotify and ignore what I've written.
Approvee number three is Mirka.
Yep. Once again, trying to trip you up with pronunciations. You've done a lot better this week. Mirka is Amelie Brun. She is she's sort of a musical chameleon, you might call her. She's released...
I wouldn't, but you can.
I mean, you could. She's released sort of pop under her own name, sort of Tori Amos kind of pop music, piano-based. She's in an indie rock band called Ex-Cops. You might remember they had a bit of a spat with McDonald's
at
South by Southwest this year. If you don't remember that, you go back and read.
It was a beef of the week, I think.
It was a beef of the week, and it was a fun one, so go back and read it. Also, listen to Mirka, which is her black metal project. She jumps around the genres a bit. She released, I think last year, she released, originally there was she did it anonymously, but then eventually came out and went, yeah, it's me, I'm doing this. She released an EP. Her debut album came out earlier this year. It's called M. It sort of mixes black metal and Nordic folk.
Of course.
Because
Why not?
But then by doing that, it kind of balances the light and dark. It's another very dramatic record, very much worth listening to.
Talking of beefs...
Mm.
Girly, which is the last of the approvees, that was a beef between you and the CMU readership.
I was just noting how, well, she's caught, I mean, she's a quite bratty teenager. I think people might find that annoying. And people finding things annoying
amuses you.
Amuses me. I enjoy it. So that's partly why I wrote about her. But she's been releasing stuff mainly on SoundCloud for, I don't know, a little while. There's a few things have come out this year. I think she's been making music for quite a while, but she's kind of happened upon this particular style of pop rap. She's very brightly coloured artist, kind of writes about being a teenager in modern London, the London of 2015. And actually her music is, for all its bratty annoyingness, is actually quite charming, very catchy. I think that she could go on to do some really impressive things that are perhaps less contentious. Not that I'm saying she should kind of tone down, because actually I think it's really good that you've got an artist who stands out amongst the kind of the many new artists who come through all the time. You know, you've got to find something that makes you stand out, and she has. And I think over time she will capitalise on that and build up something that will be really impressive.
And hopefully along the way she'll find a question mark to put at the end of her track title.
Yes, because currently it's a very deadpan, "So you think you can fuck with me, do you?"
No question mark.
I was trying to say that without a question mark.
Yeah, without the rising intonation at the end.
I'm not sure it worked.
So completemusicupdate.com/approved. Read more, listen, watch, view, enjoy, experience, share.
All of those things, yeah. Back to another story we've discussed before. In fact, just last week, this one, which was Sony ATV's unprecedented deal with Pandora. This week, Sony ATV boss Marty Bandier has, it's been made public, the memo that he sent to songwriters, bigging up the deal to them, in which he made quite a bold claim that songwriters will receive 100% of the benefits.
Yeah, which
the deal.
That can't possibly
that
be true.
That seems very unlikely.
Because that would suggest... So as we mentioned last week when we were discussing this new deal, so direct deal between Sony ATV and Pandora. Sony ATV, the world's biggest music publisher. In the past, Pandora has licensed the song copyrights predominantly through the collective licensing system in the US, so through BMI and ASCAP, where the rates are ultimately set by the rate courts. Under this deal, the rates are set commercially by the deal, and Sony ATV will be getting a slightly higher rate through the direct deal than it would through the collective licensing system. Pandora has agreed to that for the sort of the security and presumably to get rid of all the bad press it gets every time it goes to the rate court to try and get its rates down. So that is the basis of the deal. So it means that Sony ATV now are going to get slightly more money from Pandora when their songs are used. And yes, yeah, saying 100% of the benefits were passed on to the songwriter suggests that if they were getting, 10 cents before and they're getting 12 cents now, that the 2 cents will just go to songwriters. And presumably it will be split between Sony and songwriters. Otherwise, what was Sony's incentive
well,
of doing
then,
this?
I mean, surely that would mean Sony ATV would have to sign new deals with all its songwriters, because that's a different setup to what they would have in place already.
But as well as bigging up this new deal in this memo, Marty Bandier also answered at least one of the questions that we asked last week.
I think two.
Two of the questions that we asked last week when the official announcement came out. So when Sony ATV announced that it had done this deal with Pandora a week ago, immediately it's like, oh, okay, you're getting all very excited about that, and Sony ATV are saying that Pandora is not quite as evil as everyone had previously thought, and Pandora saying how Sony ATV, what was it, storied catalogue.
Yes.
You know, I've seen that word in two more press releases in the last week.
It's all becoming the new thrill.
All coming from the US. So everyone's got a storied catalogue or a storied company. And in amongst all of that, there were very few details about how this would work. And I think we said on the podcast, we certainly said in our report in the CMU Daily, well, if I was a Sony ATV songwriter, I would now have some questions about how all of this is going to work. Some of those questions remain, but some of them were answered in the memo. So as well as being told that I was getting 100% of the benefits, which I'm presumably not, the big thing, which I think we did ask last week, is how is the money paid? Because when the money is paid through the collective licensing system, which is how it has always been done with Pandora in the past, 50% of the money goes straight to the songwriter, okay? Because that's how collective licensing on the song, the publishing side, generally works. 50% of the money, oblivious of what contracts say, and publishing contracts are written to acknowledge that this is the convention. So half of the money that comes into a song collecting society on the performing rights side, I should clarify, but this is performing rights with Pandora, gets immediately played to the songwriter. The other half then goes to the publisher, which may then have to share some of that with the songwriter again, depending on how the songwriter's contract is written. But crucially, half the money goes straight to songwriter, does not go to publisher. And there's various reasons why that's important. The most important reason why it's important, the most important importance, is that obviously when you do a publishing deal with a publisher and they then commit to pay you a cut of all the money they generate from your songs, but they pay you an advance, and under a classic publishing contract, they don't have to pay you anything until you've recouped on your advance. So if they give you 50 grand up front, they take the first 50 grand to come in, and only then do they start sharing the revenues with you. But the 50% that comes to you straight from the collecting society is not subject to recoupment. So as a songwriter, unlike recording artists, generally for a recording artist, you do a record company, you don't get a royalty split until you've recouped, and so you don't get any money forever. I mean, that's not strictly speaking true because there's equitable remuneration. Let's not go down that plan. But generally, recording artists don't see much of the money coming in for the foreseeable future when they've done a record deal because they haven't recouped on contract. Whereas songwriters, even when they haven't recouped, are still getting 50% of the performing rights money directly from their collecting society. So, immediate question when the Sony ATV deal was announced last week was, well, how is the money going to reach the songwriters? Is it now going to flow into Sony and Sony will pay the songwriters? And if so, what if I haven't recouped on my publishing contract?
Yes, or is Sony going to have the collecting society still involved, as when publishers withdraw in Europe, they do joint ventures with collecting societies. Money still goes through to the collecting societies, half gets paid still, and everyone's happy. Is that going to be the setup or not? That question wasn't answered. Although we do now know that those 50% automatic payments are going to still carry on and they will not be subject to Sony, you know, counting it against recoupment. It will still come through the collecting societies.
Yeah, so the way you've described it is the way it's going to work.
Yes.
So BMI and ASCAP will still be involved in the performing rights side, so that although it will all now be done, if a Sony ATV song is performed, it will be paid at the Sony ATV rate rather than the BMI and ASCAP rate, but the money will still flow through the collective licensing system. So as a songwriter, the money will still come to you in your BMI check or your ASCAP check.
Another question was, how does this apply to co-owned songs? Because a lot of songs are not owned 100% by one publisher. There'll be probably different co-writers on a song who'd have different publishers. So in a lot of cases, Sony ATV will own only a portion of the song. It might be a small portion. But there is this thing called 100% licensing, which exists in US copyright law, which states that if you do a deal with one publisher on a song, they can offer 100% of the license on that song, and they just have to pass on the money to the other publisher or publishers.
Which is a peculiar part of US copyright laws. And over here in Europe, in the main, if you want to use a song and there are six owners, because there are six co-writers, which often there are on pop songs these days, you have to go and do separate deals with each six people, any one of whom can say, no, I'm not doing the deal. Which is why blanket licensing and collective licensing is so useful in songs, because then you don't have to do that. But you're right, in the US, in theory, Sony ATV, even if they own 5% of the song, could say, well, we can license the entire song for you, and then we'll just pass the other 95% on to the other publishers. So in theory, publishers can do that in the US, although in the main, they don't.
It's often frowned upon.
Yes. And so Marty Bandier, who, I mean, almost he has to have done it this way, because there is talk about applying this 100% licensing system, which currently only applies to direct dealing in the US. It doesn't apply to collective licensing. There is talk about applying it to collective licensing in America as part of the current review of collective licensing rules. Marty Bandier is dead set against that, and he's been very vocal of saying, we must not apply this to collective licensing. So it would be hugely hypocritical if he then did it to a massive direct deal like the one he's done with Pandora. But he has not done that, and he was very keen that his songwriters know this.
Yes, so this only relates to Sony ATV's shares of the songs in its catalogue.
Which is how it works in Europe. You mentioned there is already some direct licensing of digital services in Europe. It's all very complicated because of the split between mechanicals and performings, and the collecting societies are still involved. But what it does mean is you can have a song which is 50% Universal, 50% independent publisher, and it may be that the Universal half of the song is paid at a higher rate than the indie side of the song. So ultimately, the songwriter at the other end, two songwriters who wrote the same song and own 50% of the song each, might get paid a different royalty when it gets played on the same streaming service. And some songwriters have a bit of a problem with that, although I sort of see it as, well, that's how the world works, doesn't it? But crucially, that is what's going to happen here with the direct deal between Sony ATV and Pandora. What we don't know is what this means for non-US songwriters who are signed to Sony ATV. So I think it probably, those are the two big questions. If you're an American-based songwriter, those were the things you were going to want to know. You might still say, OK, exactly how is this distribution through BMI and ASCAP working? That might be something you want to ask about. But ultimately, those will be the big questions you wanted to ask. When it goes beyond the US, the issue is if you're a UK songwriter signed to Sony ATV, Sony ATV were never given the performing rights. PRS would have been given the performing rights, because outside of the US, that's generally how it works. The collecting society are actually assigned, sometimes they don't use that word, but in essence, they are assigned, they are given the performing right element of the song, and then the publisher, through the publishing deal, takes all of the other elements of the song. So what that means is you can't push PRS out of the equation here. And I don't think it would not even be enough to say, oh, well, we'll still let the money flow through PRS. It's like, no, PRS has to be involved in the deal making because the rights belong to PRS, not to you, Sony ATV. So it's still not entirely clear to us how this is going to work if you are, say, a UK Sony ATV signed songwriter whose music is played on Pandora. So there are still some questions to be asked. Perhaps a memo will go out to non-US songwriters this week. Someone will leak it to us and then we'll be able to clarify that next week. We'll see.
We will. Just a little footnote. We were talking about co-ownership of song rights. Yeah, it's worth mentioning, I think, that ASCAP this week announced it was adding to its database of songs the percentage ownership of those songs.
Yes.
So you can look up and see how much someone owns of a song.
That's a publicly accessible database, and that's part of the fight against this proposal to apply 100% licensing to the collective licensing system in the US. The societies don't want that. The publishers don't want that. But I suppose as a licensee, one of the reasons why you might say, well, if I've got a BMI license and I know what songs are in the BMI catalogue, I should be able to assume that I now have complete rights to use those songs and BMI will sort out divvying up the money. Because, well, I don't know, of the songs that I'm told BMI represent, I don't know which ones it completely represents and which ones it partly represents. And so this is ASCAP sort of jumping the gun and saying, well, ha-ha, now you do, because our website will tell you. So it'll be interesting to see if BMI follows suit. Certainly the boss of ASCAP announcing this, it was very much a sort of, we're leading the way here, and all of you guys, well, I hope you're going to do it too. So probably they will. And it's how useful those databases are, I don't know. But then again, more copyright ownership data that can be out there, the better. Of course, if BMI do follow ASCAP's lead here, one thing that would be interesting to do is to then compare the two databases and see whether there are any songs that they both claim to have 100% of. Because sometimes there are some conflicts between the databases.
I think as it's more common, someone will claim 60% and someone will claim 50%.
Yes. So there might be some interesting mathematical games you could play. That's something to look forward to. If only BMI could get this sorted by Christmas, then there you go. That could be your Christmas day in your garden. You could be looking for where there are song ownership clashes in the American collective licensing system.
That sounds like fun.
It does. I'm going to have a matchmaker while I think about that.
Just quickly, time to look through a few of the things that didn't make the list for full discussion this week. An interesting update to the Happy Birthday to You case. You might remember we discussed this on the podcast a few weeks ago. A court in the US decided that in America, Warner Chappell, despite what it's been claiming for some time now, does not own the rights to Happy Birthday to You. This week, an education charity set up by one of the co-writers of Happy Birthday to You came forward and said, well, one, as a beneficiary of money from this song, it stands to lose out if it turns out that the song is public domain, which it might be. It also said it thought it might own the rights.
Yes, so one of the Hill sisters wrote Happy Birthday, bequeathed and helped set up this charity through a foundation. And so what they're saying is, well, if it turns out the Hill sisters never transferred ownership of Happy Birthday lyrics to their publisher, which was subsequently bought by Warner Chappell, well, that probably means they therefore left it to us in their will. And so rather than completely losing out on the Happy Birthday money, which is one possible outcome of all of this, actually we'll take all of the money and we'll own the copyright outright. So an interesting little side story. This case is very much rumbling on. All sides aren't particularly happy with the current state of affairs. So no doubt we'll come back to this at some point. But what it means is there's now a third party expressing an interest in having an
opinion. It was already complicated. It's yes. Just got more complicated. Talking of complications, Universal Music currently not being played on Foxtel-owned TV stations in Australia due to a dispute. We're not quite sure what the dispute is.
Yeah, so Foxtel, ultimately owned by the Murdoch Empire, or half-owned, I think. They have 5 of their own music channels, not currently playing any Universal Music
which
music
is a
videos,
lot of music, especially pop TV stations.
An awful lot of music. And of course, what it does mean is, in terms of pop music, as this podcast goes out, it's the big One Direction versus Justin Bieber day. They're both bringing out their new albums. I imagine there'll be a lot of One Direction on those channels and no Justin Bieber. So you have your own opinion on whether or not that's a happy eventuality from this licence dispute.
The grant awarded to Tea in the Park by the Scottish Government is being audited.
Yes.
Someone's going to try to work out if it should indeed have been given that grant.
Or not.
It was money to help move sites, as Indeed. It did earlier this year, not without controversy. This is something we've talked about before.
It has
as
been
well.
discussed in the Scottish Parliament, and now, Audit Scotland is going to investigate and see whether or not any dodginess happened in the distribution of that money.
The mega upload trial, we said we'd talk about it again, and here it is. Judge has been asking questions about the lost mega upload data, which I think we've discussed before as well.
Yes.
There is data from Mega Upload still stored in servers. Some server companies have wiped their servers and repurposed them. But the biggest one in America, Carpathia Hosting, still has a big warehouse full of servers,
data.
Full of data.
That was on Mega Upload before it was shut down in 2012.
And there's been this long debate about, would it be possible to just turn the servers on, let people take their data back, and then turn them off again? And that's what the judge was asking about this week.
Yeah, so while the Mega Upload team over in New Zealand are still, the extradition hearing is still ongoing, this is a separate thing happening over in the US. And yes, no major development except that the judge has gone to each of the interested parties and asked some very specific questions. So hopefully that means we'll get some resolution on this quite soon.
I suspect the answer will still be no, that's not possible. Contactor, the Russian social network, again, something we've discussed before. This week, it and Warner and Universal both claimed victory in their court case. This week, Contactor has very much lost a court case, or two court cases, against two Russian indie labels, and is having to pay damages for copyright infringement.
Yeah, so various labels have accused Contactor, as Andy Malt insists that we call it, because apparently that's how you call it.
Apparently that's how it's said. I might look it up again.
Accused them of infringing copyright for allowing their users to share music files over their networks. And as you say, although in the Sony Warner case, the judge said, hey, Contactor, do more to combat piracy, he didn't give the majors damages, whereas these were two Russian independent labels sued, and they did get damages. And actually, from a sort of UK or certainly a US perspective, the damages were very low. They were not talking about million-dollar damages here. But still, it sets an interesting precedent under Russian copyright law, although Contactor still managed to claim a victory in these cases somehow. So who knows? Hey, something we haven't talked about on the podcast before,
certainly
since the podcast came back, and actually while the podcast was running in its original version 1 state, there was never an occasion really to talk about Busted, and the whole Mook Busted thing happened while we were on a break. Why are we talking about Busted in 2015?
Because Busted are back.
And no Mook here.
This may be our and finally story, but arguably this is the biggest news story in music of the week. Busted are reuniting with Charlie Simpson.
Charlie Simpson, who said...
Never.
Never.
Never, ever, ever.
There is pretty much only the Smiths left, aren't there? Of all of the bands where there was a bit of tension and they split and they're like, never, 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 they all come back eventually. And I remember hearing on the grapevine when Mook Busted, so when Matt Willis and James Bourne joined up with the McFly guys and did that big tour, and there was a bit of a flurry then, or would Charlie Simpson take part? And I remember talking to somebody who knew the management of Fightstar, which obviously was Charlie Simpson's other, more serious band. And they were like, no, he's just not interested. He's just not interested. They've made him an offer, lots of money. He's just not interested. What's changed? Has the offer got better? Has life moved on?
Well, there's...
Did he not think the Mook Busted thing was going to be quite the success that it was?
Possibly. There are different ways of looking at this, aren't there? One is how it's been presented in the comeback, in that, hey, the time was right, it just worked out, yeah, it'd be nice, we had some unfinished business, this is all cool. The other one is Charlie Simpson's got a mortgage to pay, and this is the best way to do it. However, it was rumoured at the time, and seemingly confirmed in their press conference this week, that when they came out with Mook Busted, so the McFly Busted supergroup minus Charlie Simpson, Charlie not only said, I don't want any part of this, he sold his rights to the Busted brand to the rest of them for what was rumoured to be a six-figure sum. Someone brought that up in the press conference and they sort of glossed over it. But I think Matt Willis did say, yeah, he works for us now. But so clearly Charlie's got some money. It's not millions, but Charlie's got some money.
So it's the glory he is after.
It's the glory. I mean, so maybe when he says, a little while ago, he started hanging out with James Bourne again. They got over their differences. It was all ironed out. And then they were like, well, let's, see. He said in this video they put out, he said that, they went, well, let's just see. Let's go. We'll go to a studio. We'll mess around, play some old songs, record some new stuff. if anything good comes of it, if it seems to be working, then maybe we'll try and do something. And that's why they've got back together. It's just felt like the right time to do it. And they all said, and none of them ever thought this would happen. And here it is happening.
Here it is. So tour is incoming. So if having two-thirds of Busted singing their old songs with McFly as a backing band, I don't even know how McBusted worked. There was a McBusted record, wasn't there? Did they? They worked on some new material.
It was not very good.
So, but if that did not satisfy you, if you were not interested in a weird McFly bit of Busted amalgamation, they will be back. Although, there is also going to be new material, is the fret. This is not just going to be a hit tour. I suppose they were very young when Busted was... I mean, Busted wasn't around very long. They burned up quite quickly. They were very young, and they were very sort of teenage songs.
Well, that's it. I think, I mean, they will have had to cross this bridge with McBusted, but I think it's probably more pronounced now that it's going to be three guys in their 30s singing a song called What I Go to School For.
About having a crush on a teacher who would... the teacher in the song would be more or less their age. So yes, it will be interesting to see how they reinterpret the old songs and whether the new songs are god-awful, which... Well, they could be.
They could be, but, you know, they could be brilliant.
They could be.
This could be the best reunion ever.
I was always quite a big fan of Busted. I liked Busted, and I liked early McFly as well. So, you know, perhaps I should be
early
more excited.
McFly. What a thing to say. Oh, yeah, I was really into early McFly. I've got a few of the demos. That was when they were really raw.
Well, they did that sort of dancey album, didn't they? Sort of more, never really knew what that was about.
Oh, there was, yeah.
So perhaps I should be more excited about this than I am. But I don't think I'll be going. Who knows? Looking back at sort of the Busted days, actually the thing I sort of remember most amusingly from that period is when people forget that the Jonas Brothers, when they were first a thing, did two cover versions, I think, of the of Busted tracks.
Yes.
Their first tracks, they were covers, because Busted never really made it in America. So they nabbed two of the tracks. I think they did Year 3000, but they also did What I Went to School For. And so that was one, I think, the first Jonas Brothers track. And it is on YouTube. If you go and look it up, it'll be there somewhere. But because they were sort of a really wholesome... Were they a Disney band, Jonas Brothers?
Yeah.
Anyway, because they were a really wholesome American band, the idea of them lusting after, and I think in the actual lyrics of the song, getting the middle-aged teacher was not wholesome enough for the Jonas Brothers. So they redid the song that it was a crush on another pupil at the school, which completely destroys the entire point of the song. And it sort of renders the entire cover version pointless. So I always found that quite amusing. And you can go and find that on YouTube. So that's the main thing I remember about Busted first time round.
Do you think maybe they'll do the Jonas Brothers version on the reunion tour?
Perhaps
that would be worse, wouldn't it?
What I go to work for.
What
do I go to my tedious office job for? That's what I'm expecting.
They should update all of the songs.
They really should, yes. All of their songs should be for men in their 30s in an office job. If they did that, I would go to the reunion gigs. So perhaps we can lobby for that. Hey, I think this may have been the longest, not only the longest CMU podcast in history. I mean, it is our 23rd anniversary.
Yeah.
So I suppose, you know, we're due a little bit of extra time. But I've, unless there's a lot of things cut out in the edit.
Well, we've had to cut out you eating matchmakers the whole way through.
Which, the fact comes to think of it, there might be a lot coming out in the edit. Sorry, Matt, very long edit. But this, not only might this be the longest ever CMU podcast, I think it may be the longest ever podcast. So I apologise for that. Especially as when we talked about what we were going to talk about on the podcast earlier today. We were like, nothing's happened this week. We have nothing to
say. 20-minute podcast,
nothing
easy.
Nothing to say about anything. And it turns out we have an awful lot to say about Apple Music and Victory Records and Sony ATV and Busted.
Well, of course we've got a lot to say about Busted. But now we've run out, so I'll just
I'm
do
gonna
the
have a
outro.
Matchmaker.
Just wait 30 seconds while I do the flipping outro.
I will eat it away from the mic so I don't ruin the bit where you say Andy Malt, Chris Cook, Matt PTE, subscribe, blah, blah, blah.
What do you go to school for? Why don't you tell us at CMU on Twitter and educate yourself further? There's a nice little segue by making sure you're subscribed to the podcast wherever you're listening to it, so you can get it automatically next week. And this podcast, what I just mentioned and you've just listened to, was presented by me, Andy Malt, and Chris Cook. It was produced by Matt Peaty. For more CMU stuff, go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.
I'm going to have a matchmaker.
You want your child to thrive and reach their full potential. K-12 can help them get there. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. This is not your typical homeschooling. With state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online, your child will learn at their speed, at home, with innovative, engaging technology. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.